Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, the internet crowd is already with us. I'm sort of kind of close to starting on time.
Well, it's too bad we couldn't see them all.
Yes. That's right. We have a good-looking group in the front here. I will attempt to be interesting for your sake. But I also have to forewarn you, for the people sitting right up front here, that I throw things at people who are... You never know. We are in Leviticus 15 tonight. We're going to be concentrating most of the evening on Leviticus 16, but we left off 2 weeks ago at Leviticus 14. I'm very thankful to Len for covering for me last week. Even though I anticipated being in Chattanooga, instead I was in bed. But I appreciate that Len was here. It worked out fortuitously that God knew I was going to need somebody to preach for me one way or the other on Wednesday. And I got to hear it when I put it up online, and I really enjoyed his third installment on his series on Jonah. In fact, I said to him, all right, you have 2 weeks to prepare for part four. And he is now preparing. And hopefully one Wednesday next month, he'll get to finish up his Jonah series. Now, we're going to talk tonight about the yearly Day of Atonement, one of the most important calendar events in the Hebrew calendar, one of the most important institutions that God put in place as part of the Old Testament law. I mean, this is top shelf stuff. This is the kind of stuff that were it you or me writing this down, this is the moment at which we would want the gold vellum, we'd want the beautiful leaf writing, because we're talking about Day of Atonement stuff. This is the stuff that directly connects to what Christ did in the New Testament. This is really, really vitally important, high, holy, righteous stuff. So, because I'm me, I think, well, how did God frame this? What did he put before it? And what did he put after it? Because you know that these numbers that make up our chapters and verses were added during the period of the Reformation. They were not in the original documents. Moses was not getting chapter and verse from God. God was not reciting it and saying, now, chapter 15, verse 3. The numbers were added later so that we all collectively could end up at the same place at the same time. So they serve a purpose, but we have a psychological barrier when we see those numbers. We think that when we get to the end of chapter 15 and the beginning of chapter 16, that somehow there's a change of venue, a change of approach, a change of subject, something that would be the reason that number's there. But when Moses originally wrote it, it was just a series of commands. Commands, 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 Day of Atonement commands, other commands. So back to my original question. So how did God bracket the Day of Atonement, one of the most important Old Testament practices that he put in place for Israel? How did he bracket it? Well, chapter 15 is about bodily secretions, and then immediately after Day of the Atonement, who you can have sex with. Those are the brackets. Now we have to go back and ask the original question that I've asked all the way through the book of Exodus and Leviticus, which is, if the law can indeed be broken into moral and civil and ceremonial subcategories, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about the fact that Moses jumps right from bodily secretions to the Day of Atonement? And he's perfectly comfortable jamming those two ideas right up against each other. And you'll notice that every time I have said the phrase, so far this evening, every time I've said the phrase bodily secretions, people go, ooh, which is natural. Because we, part of our Puritan upbringing and background, we like to clean the Bible up. We like to clean ourselves up. We like to think that we're really not all that base. But the Bible's very, very earthy. The Bible's very clear and and very unembarrassed about the fact that we have physical needs. We do bodily things. And God is not afraid to talk about it. God who made you exactly this way. And he knows how your body works. And he understands your digestive system. And he's not embarrassed by it. In fact, it's one of the great marvels of how he made us. And he understands that sometimes our bodies get sick. And when our bodies get sick, we have things like snot. It's not attractive, but we have it. God knows it. God talks about it. He's fine with that. It's just that we in polite civil society have tried to clean up the Bible and clean ourselves up so that we don't have to talk about those embarrassing things. But chapter 15 is chock full of embarrassing things. And I got two front rows full of kids here.
Timing is everything.
Timing is everything. And the parents staring at me. Like, well, are you really going to talk about this? You know, 2 weeks ago when we finished chapter 14, we got in the car and James literally said to me, good thing you didn't go on to chapter 15.
I read ahead.
He read ahead. Yeah, because chapter 15 is very earthy. So we can, yeah. Jennifer said, can we just survey verse chapter 15? And we can, but I prefer to say, you know, God's not afraid of it. What are we afraid of? God put it in our Holy Bible. Why do we think that we can't talk about it if God can? We want so badly to clean God up. We want so badly to make God fall in line with our sensitivities. But God knows what you're like. He knows how he made you. Chapter 15, verse 1 says, the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, if any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean. He's talking about a sore, a wound, anything that might have pus. Go ahead, say it as a group. He says that's unclean. So if you have a sickness, a sore, remember we just got done with all the leprosy rules and all the leprosy laws. So he's continuing to say, if you have any kind of an oozing sore, a discharge out of your body, that you are unclean. And then he talks about the uncleanness that is part of that discharge. And from there, the rest of chapter 15 is about, go ahead and just read it. It's going to say the same thing in your Bible as it says in my Bible. It's all about bodily secretions and times when you are unclean and how you go about cleaning yourself up. It is directly from talking about the most unclean, impure things that people can do that chapter 16 leaps right into the day of the Lord. So for Jennifer's sake, we're going to start at chapter 16, verse 1. He did not omit personal hygiene and every aspect of it.
Yep. I understand that because the Jews later in the Middle Ages were being keeping the cleanliness laws, they avoided the Black Plague and the people that were suffering from it accused them of being witches. Right.
There are plenty of advantages to following the hygiene rules that the Bible prescribes. Yeah, exactly. Not only does it make you more pleasant to be around, but it keeps you from getting sick. Now, I'm going to read pretty much verse by verse all the way through chapter 16 for two reasons. Number one, I really want you to feel the details of the Day of Atonement. God was very specific and very detailed about it. And the more you understand about the Day of Atonement, the more you understand the atoning work of Christ that we find in the New Covenant. The second reason is, I just believe that there's really nothing more fun than listening to Jim Reed. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron. When they had approached the presence of the Lord and they had died. Do you remember what happened to Aaron's two sons? Mm-hmm. Why'd they die?
They tried to change the scents.
Yeah, they tried to change the particular odors that God had said, when you come and burn incense before me, make this mixture and this mixture only. Because God has the absolute right, the absolute authority to say, this is how you approach me. And if you attempt to approach him any other way, he has the absolute right and the absolute authority and the willingness to kill, because he is that holy. So if he says, you approach me this way, you approach him that way. If he says, you approach me via these rules, these standards, if you approach me through this ceremony, then you do it. If he says, the only way to approach me is through Christ, then you do it. This ties in with what we've been seeing on Sunday mornings in John 6. Jesus saying, I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. Jesus saying things like, no man can come to the Father. No man can come to me except the Father draw him. And no man gets to the Father except through me. God has the absolute right and complete jurisdiction to say how you approach him. And there are a great many philosophies, religions, ideas through the history of mankind, because people want to define for themselves how they will approach God. And then they think that they can obligate God to respond to their made-up notions of how God is supposed to be. But if we see anything so far through the books of Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus so far, what we've seen clearly is that God is under no compunction to do things your way. He's under no obligation to do things your way. And he's very clear about how to do things his way. So once again, he says to Moses, after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they had approached the presence of the Lord and had died, the Lord said to Moses, tell your brother Aaron that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, unless he die. Notice how often God says that. Do this my way or die. Now, you've got this tent in the wilderness. You've got this tent that everywhere Israel went for 40 years, they had to carry with them. They had to break it down, carry it with them, put it back up. Wherever the presence of God stopped, they had to build the tent. And the outside of the tent just looked like animal skin, looked very plain on the outside. On the inside, beautiful curtains and color and gold and furniture. And even inside that tent, the outer tent, which was called the tent of meeting, even in that outer court, only the priests, only the sons of Aaron could go in or could serve there. Common people couldn't go there. God, once again, exercising his right to say, you don't come in, you don't come near me. Only the people I say can come near me can come near me. And if anyone else attempts to get near me, I kill them. Because that's the way God works. But then among the priests and the sons of Aaron and the Levites and all those that could work in the tent itself, there is a separate tent, a place called the holiest place. This is the place that only Aaron could go, only the high priest, and he could only go once a year, and he could only go if he was wearing the right clothes, and he could only go if he had the right blood from the right sacrifice of the right bull, and he could only go in at the time God said to go in, and God even, in describing the clothing that he would wear, included the fact that he would wear bells around his garment so that the people outside could hear the bells ringing, because if the bells ever stopped ringing, he had done something wrong, he's dead. Because God was real, real specific about how you approach him. So he said, tell your brother Aaron that he shall not enter at any time into the holiest place inside the veil, before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die, for I will appear in a cloud over the mercy seat. Aaron shall enter the holy place with this, with a bull for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. Now, once he goes inside the veil that separates the tent of meeting from the holiest place, what's inside that smaller tent in the Holy of Holies? What's inside there? The Ark of the Covenant. What's on top of the Ark of the Covenant? The mercy seat. What's inside the Ark of the Covenant? Oh, you're ahead of yourselves. At this moment, what's inside it? Rod of Aaron's not in there yet. We haven't gotten there yet. And the Ten Commandments. Okay, what do the Ten Commandments constitute? The whole of the law. Exactly. So what you've got here, you've got a golden box that is containing the law of God in Ten Commandments. And if you break any one of them, You are guilty before God. So that would make everybody guilty. So the law is contained inside the golden box with a cap on it, the kappareth that is called the mercy seat. Because nobody can stand in front of the law of God and not be guilty. What you need between you and the law of God is mercy, and lots of it. And on the mercy seat, there are two angels, and they are carved out of one molding of gold. And the two angels are looking toward the center of the kappareth, the place where the glory of God is going to come down and rest between the two cherubim. And the cherubim's angels wrap around until they meet in the center, creating that space in the middle where their faces are looking inward, where God is going to meet with Israel. So all of the symbology is very specific. That for God to come and make atonement for his people, there has to be the mercy of God covering people from the law that would condemn them. All of that is inside this inner tent. So God is teaching, teaching, teaching all the time, which is why he is so particular, so fastidious, and so careful to say, don't mess up my typology. If you do it the wrong way, I'll mess you up. So Aaron will enter the holy place with the bull of a sin offering and the ram of a burnt offering, and he shall put the holy linen tunic on, and the linen undergarment shall be next to his body, and he shall be girded with the linen sash, and attired with the linen turban. These are the holy garments. What is in the linen turban that makes the turban so important? There's a golden plate with an engraving that says, holiness to the Lord. Because when God looks down on the high priest, on his servant, making the sacrifice of atonement for Israel, the first thing in gold on his forehead, the first thought God wants to see is God is holy. And we have to remember to always define God first and foremost, primarily, by his holiness. I've pointed it out enough times that you could probably repeat it with me. But you will notice that the plate on Aaron's head does not say love. People would like it to say love. They would like to say that God's primary attribute is his love. They would like to think that when they get to heaven, there's going to be angels around the throne singing, all you need is love. But that's not all you need. You can love like crazy as a human being and never reach God-type love. The holiness of God motivates both his love and his jealousy and his wrath and his judgment. All of those are wrapped up in the absolute holiness of God. So when the high priest approaches God for the atonement, the first foremost thought in gold on his forehead has to be holiness to the Lord. So he'll put on all of those things, and he shall bathe his body in water, and then he will put all that on. So God wants to make sure the priest is clean too. And he shall take from the congregation of the sons of Israel two male goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. Then Aaron shall offer the bull for a sin offering, which is for himself, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household. And he shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat. Now, this is just fascinating. I'm going to try really hard to make this gruesome, and I'm going to put flesh and blood on it as much as I can, because I want you to see how gruesome the whole killing the ox thing is. And it's gruesome, it's ugly, it's brutal. And so is killing the ram. And just about the time it makes you squeamish, remember, that's what sin requires. For sin comes death. Paul's very clear about it. The wages of sin is death. Somebody sins, somebody dies. So way back here in Leviticus, God starts teaching substitutionary atonement, which means that someone can die in your place. And he was teaching it all the way back here in Leviticus so that in the New Testament they would already be familiar with the concept. So that when John the Baptist was at the River Jordan and pointed at Jesus and said, behold the Lamb that takes away the sin of the world, they would already be familiar with the concept because for 1,400 years they had been killing sacrificial animals in a substitutionary way. Aaron's going to cast lots. Now that we've got these two goats, one of the two goats is going to die. The other goat is going to go free. And you know how they determine which is which? They cast lots, which sounds random. Were it not for the fact that in Proverbs 16:33, somebody turn there real quick. Proverbs 16:33. Mark this, because we think that there are random events in life. We think that there's randomness in the world, that there ought to be at least some things that God is not in control of. And so we have what we call games of chance, and we've built an entire city around it. You can go to Las Vegas and you can play games of chance, which anybody who's ever been to Las Vegas will tell you there's no chance there. The house is going to win. They did not build all those hotels on people going home with more money than they came with. You're going to lose. But the appeal is the notion that something random might happen in your favor. That if you threw the dice enough times, that a combination might come up where you win and you beat the house. And we like to think that that's random. Well, the Old Testament equivalent of that is casting lots. And so Proverbs 16:33 says, Megan, why don't you read it?
The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord.
The lot is cast into the lap, which would be the same as throwing dice. But Solomon says, and every decision made with the lot is in God's hands. Absolutely zero randomness in God's universe. Which means that when God says, cast lots for the two goats, you'll notice that before you cast the lots, you had to present the two goats at the door of the tent. So you bring the two goats to the tent, and God chooses which one. And then you find out which one by casting the lot. There's absolutely no randomness here. Now that's reassuring to somebody like me. Because if life were indeed random, if there were things that could happen in this life that were just happenstance, if things could happen that were outside the purview of God, then that means that many of the really bad things that have happened to me in my life had no purpose. They just happened randomly. They just occurred, and God couldn't stop them, and God couldn't do anything about it. Gee, what a shame. That looks like it hurt. Too bad. But if there is, in fact, control over the falling of dice, or the casting of lot, or the choosing of the scapegoat from the sacrificial goat, if God is that involved in the details, in the minutia, then he's that involved in absolutely every aspect of your life. And what that means is every aspect of your life and every event in it has purpose, because it's in the hands of a God who does everything on purpose. That should give you a great deal of comfort. I don't know. In fact, this evening Tom came in to me and started the night by saying, I don't know how people who don't believe in Jesus get through the day. Because of the way the political atmosphere is and the way the world is today and all the rabble-rousers on the radio and everybody getting all worked up and people are pretty soon just going to run for the caves and the hills. And it's getting harder and harder to make sense of the craziness that's going on in the world. But if God is in charge, then nothing that is happening is outside of his exact plan. Let's go back to the start. Sure, let's. Genesis 1:1. Well, you have to start somewhere. In the Garden of Eden. In fact, before the Garden of Eden. Let's go back further than that. Satan fell. Satan rebelled in heaven in ages past. Was that random?
No.
Or was that on purpose? If you say it was on purpose, can you prove it biblically? Let's say, for instance, that you do agree that this was on purpose. God had a plan. God had a design. He created Satan, a created being, a created angel, and Satan fell because Satan was so raised up in his own beauty and his ego. And as we read out of Isaiah, Satan said, I will set up my throne in the place of the north. I will be worshipped as God. Did that happen and surprise God, or did that happen exactly the way God intended? Okay, can you prove that?
I can.
How do you prove it?
I prove it biblically by saying that throughout the Bible, Satan has had one after another role somewhere in the Bible.
That's exactly right. That's very adept. Did you understand what he just said? See, what we have to understand about Satan is God's foot soldier. People have created this theology through the years that makes Satan and God co-equal. Where you say, well, it's God has a vote, and the devil has a vote, and now you cast the deciding vote. And that's how you decide whether you're going to heaven or hell. Or they create that theology that says there's this, you know, this war in heaven where God is just doing his best, hanging on by his fingernails, just doing everything he can to try to save some people. But the devil just seems to have so much power, so much authority. You get to the end of the book of Revelation, and God sends an angel, sends Michael. He says, go down there, put him in a chain, put him in the abyss, put a seal on the abyss, and keep him there for 1,000 years. Couldn't God do that anytime he wanted?
Right.
Yeah. Well, then why didn't he do it the minute Satan rebelled?
He had a purpose.
He had a purpose. He had a plan. You see, ultimately, the whole plan of God, the whole purpose of God, is his own glorification and the glorification of his Son. So hold on to that thought. So now we get to the Garden of Eden. And God tells Adam and Eve, the first two people on the planet, you can eat of any tree in the garden except that one. Don't eat from that one. Did God expect them to eat from that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you know?
Because he wouldn't pick that one unless he knew that they would have done it.
Yeah. If you don't want them to eat from that tree, don't put it in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that obvious? Now look, if you and I can figure that out, you don't think God could have figured that one out? Then on top of that, not only does he put that tree in the garden, he lets the devil in.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think God knew that there was a conversation going on between the serpent and the woman?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's omniscient. He knows everything. So why did he hang out until later in the day before they heard him walking in the garden in the cool of the evening? What was he doing in the afternoon? Why wasn't he there going, ho, ho, ho? What are you two talking about? You see, all of this is according to God's plan exactly because God's ultimate goal is his glorification and the glorification of his Son. Now, the way that his Son gets the greatest glory is in atoning for and saving a particular people. And that means there had to be people to save. And so God, though we can't charge God with sin, God was able to make people and then use the devil to bring about the fall in order that there would be human beings for Jesus to save. It's all part of his divine plan. He's teaching it all the way back here in Leviticus. He's teaching that Jesus is going to come and save and redeem particular people. And none of it is an accident because even the goat that lives or the goat that dies is in the hands of God when they cast the lot. So let's then bring it down to you, individually. How is it that you know anything about the things of God?
His will.
His will, his choice, his determination. It always has been that way, is my point. Now, between these two goats, one of them is going to die. The other goat is going to have the sins of Israel placed on his head, and then he's going to be taken out into the wilderness, and he's going to escape. That's why he's called the scapegoat. And he's going to escape with the sins of Israel on his head, but he's going to go on and live his life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be up to God which one dies and which one lives. So verse 7, I think that's where we were. He shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats. One lot for the Lord, that means he's going to die, and the other lot for the scapegoat, the one that's going to run away. Then Aaron shall offer the goat on which the lot for the Lord fell and make it a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot for the scapegoat fell shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it, to send it into the wilderness as the scapegoat. Now there's typology here that I should explain, long as we're talking about the scapegoat. Jesus fulfilled both of those goats. He died in the place of sinners so that they would not have to die. He became the sin offering, the lamb that took away the sin of the world. But he also became our scapegoat. What they're going to do with the scapegoat is put their hands on his head, a transference of guilt from the high priest, who is a representative of Israel, to that goat. And then that goat is taken into the wilderness, never to be heard from or seen again. And he's going to carry the sins away from the camp of Israel. And that's exactly why Jesus had to spend 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth, because he had the sin of his people placed on him. Paul's very clear to say, he who knew no sin became sin for us. And then he died with that sin on him, and he took that sin into the grave, and when he came up out of that grave, he was sinless, he was perfect. He even said to Mary, "Don't touch me, I haven't yet ascended to the Father." He couldn't be touched by anyone or anything, because that would make him unclean, because he was perfected at that moment. So that being the case, where'd the sin go? All the sin of all his people was imputed to him, taken to the cross, goes into the grave. 3 days later, he comes out, "Don't touch me, I'm perfect." Where'd all the sin go? It's left there. It's left in the grave, taken into the belly of the earth, which is why David would say things like, "As far as the east is from the west." That's how far God has removed our sin from us. So the whole of the Old Testament continues to lead up to the sacrificial work of Christ. It's all teaching that same theme over and over, the fact that you couldn't be good enough to do it for yourself, so you needed a substitute. So both the sin offering and the scapegoat are types of Christ. So verse 11, "Then Aaron shall offer the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and to make atonement for himself, and for his household, and he shall slaughter the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself. And he shall take a fire pan full of coals of fire from upon the altar before the Lord, and two handfuls of finely ground sweet incense, and bring it inside the veil." That means inside the Holy of Holies. "And he shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the Ark of the Testimony, lest he die." God says, "Now do it exactly my way." I'm really being specific here. Now, we know from earlier passages how these animals were killed. The goat would have his back legs tied up, and then he would be strung up, and his throat would be slit, and they would use a pan to catch the blood that would flow out of the goat. We can almost imagine doing that. Almost, because goat, manageable size. Then you've got to kill an ox. And you have to catch the blood of the ox. You have to slice the ox head open, which begins to smell bad really fast. And you have to catch enough of this blood that you've got a pan of it. Now remember, you're talking about the high priest, beautiful clothing, perfectly clean, white turban, and he's carrying around dead carcasses and blood. And he has to dip his hand into the blood and get the blood on his fingers and go in front of the mercy seat and sprinkle the blood on the ground with his hands. And it gets on him, it gets on the clean clothes, it's on the ground, it's on the Ark of the Covenant. It's ugly. It's brutal. It's bloody. We think of atonement as, you know, a wonderful, high, holy, supreme act of God, atonement for sin. But we have to recognize that atonement is as ugly as sin is. It is a bloody thing to do. But Calvary was no picnic. Remember that Christ paid a very bloody price. See, it wasn't just a matter of nailing him to a chunk of wood. You have to remember the beatings he took across his back, the crown of thorns and the way it made him bleed out. Remember that they plucked his beard out, then blindfolded him while they punched him in the face and mocked him and made fun of him and said, now prophesy, who's hitting you? I mean, that's just cruel. And then after they had stripped the skin off his back, they then put the chunk of wood on his back and paraded him through the street and made him carry it, bleeding through the streets. And as if that weren't enough, then nailed him through his hands, through his feet, to that chunk of wood. Here's my point. Atonement is really ugly business. It requires blood, it requires sacrifice, and it requires a high priest to get between you and God because your sin requires that kind of bloodiness. You understand me? Because the more you feel God's absolute repugnance with your sin, and the more you understand what God is willing to do in physical terms to show how much he hates sin, the more you recognize that, the more you will appreciate that you don't have to pay that price. And the more you recognize and appreciate the price Christ paid, the easier it is to worship him rightly. If he's just your homeboy, if he's just your best buddy, if Jesus is your boyfriend or your co-pilot, Jesus, take the wheel. If he's just your driver when you're in trouble, I'm sorry, I just broke into a Carrie Underwood song. Thank you and good night. The dumbing down of Jesus that's happening in our society these days and in so much of Christianity has reduced him to merely a good luck charm, somebody who can make your life better, somebody you can wear like a groovy shirt. And what he really is everything that's wrapped up in the dead ox and in the dead goats and in the sprinkling blood and in the caperith and the covering that would guard you from the wrath of God that is inside that box in the law. All of that is what Christ did, and he had to do it in a really brutal, ugly, bloody, painful way so that you wouldn't have to. You want to see the extreme of it? When he was on the cross, one of the last things that the Gospels record he said was that he cried out, "Why have you forsaken me?" It became so brutal at that moment that the image, the picture, the word forsaken has to do with turning away or turning your back. The picture is that God and Christ, who had always been in unison, who had always been face to face, who had always been in that ideal state of holy love with each other, that at that moment when Christ became our sin sacrifice, God himself turned from him because he became sin for us. And God couldn't look on him anymore because he was sin. So Christ went so far as to reach the point where he would cry out in agony, "Why have you forsaken me?" And yet, you and I have the promise from Christ, "I will never leave you. I will never forsake you." Do you realize how good you've got it? Christ was turned on, forsaken by God, in the midst of an absolutely brutal, bloody punishment, so that you could live with the assurance that God would never leave you and would never forsake you. See, that's the good news. That's the good news of the gospel, but it was purchased with a really high price. And if it was purchased with that high a price, then the one who did the purchasing feels completely at ease coming to you and laying himself on you and saying, "You're mine, you belong to me. Come with me." And so far, nobody in all of human history has been able to resist that effective call because it's the call of the one who already bought you and you belong to him. So the same God that you find all the way in the Old Testament saying, "You can only come to me one way," is the same God in Jesus Christ saying, "And here's the way." And once he opens up that way to you and says, "Come with me," you're going to follow because he is Lord and Savior based on his designation, not based on you making him that. You understand me? All right. Verse 12, and he'll take a fire pan full of coals of fire upon the altar to the Lord, and two handfuls of finely ground sweet incense, and bring it inside the veil, and he shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the ark of the testimony, lest he die. Moreover, he shall take some, read verse 14, and put flesh and blood on it. Don't just read this like it's a story. Realize that human beings did this for 1,400 years.
And they didn't just do one.
Over, oh, yes, yes. Moreover, he shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat on the east side, and also in the front of the mercy seat, he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger seven times. Splat. More blood. Splat. Blood on his hands. Splat. Do you really think that he could splatter blood on the ground and on the mercy seat and on the front of the ark and not get any on him? Walking around with a bowl of bull blood and putting it down in front of the mercy seat. Verse 15, then he shall slaughter the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil, and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and in front of the mercy seat. So it's not enough to do the bull thing and walk back out and go, whew, man, I'm glad that's over. Now you have to go kill another animal. Go kill the goat. Collect the blood from the goat, go back inside, sprinkle blood, more blood, more blood, more blood. I get asked frequently by people who don't like the Bible and don't like the way the Bible works. They'll say to me, you know, that's a bloody book you've got. They'll say, why is it so full of blood? There is so much blood in the Bible. And the answer is simple. There's so much blood because there's so much sin. Non-stop sin required non-stop blood. And notice that the bull was for Aaron and his family and for the cleansing of the stuff in the Ark of the Covenant and the furniture around it and the tent of meeting. So Aaron had to sanctify every piece of furniture. We already read all that. And the clothing had to be sanctified. And we read all that. But then before he could sacrifice for the people, he had to sacrifice for himself because he was sinful. And then he has to go in and cleanse everything in the temple with blood. Everything gets blood on it in order to cleanse it and make it holy before God will make an appearance. And when God looks down, he's got to see the priest, he's got to see the clothes, he's got to see the bull, he's got to see the goat, he's got to see the blood, he's got to see all that. And if he sees all that, the pillar of smoke comes down out of heaven and rests on the mercy seat, and Israel can see it. And they know that for another year, God was pleased and accepted the sacrifice. But you know what? Next year, got to do it again. Because the blood of bulls and the blood of goats could never, once and for all, take away sin. It could only put off the punishment for a little while. Yes, Charlie?
Wait, so this is different from the daily sacrifices?
Yes, this is the once-a-year Day of Atonement sacrifice.
Sacrifices all through the year?
There are sin offerings and burnt offerings that happen on and off during the year, depending on different people bringing different sacrifices. But God doesn't show up in a pillar of fire that day, and you're not allowed to go into the Holy of Holies except on this day. So this is the one day where the high priest is atoning specifically for Israel's sin. Which brings up an interesting point, by the way, and I'm glad you brought that up. Pardon me?
Is this a fall festival?
This is. This is seventh month, 10th day. These are the fall feasts, Feast of Trumpet, Feast of Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles. And we've been reading through the book of Leviticus so far, all the multiple things that God said is a sin. That's a sin, that's a sin, that's a sin. Don't do that, that's a sin. And all of them required bring an animal, kill an animal, more blood, sin sacrifice, sin sacrifice, sin sacrifice. Even if you did all that right, on the Day of Atonement, they still had to atone for the sins of Israel, which means even if you kept all the rest of the laws, brought all the rest of the animals, killed all the birds, killed all the sheep, did everything else you were supposed to do, brought all your tenths and your tithes, if you brought all your burnt offerings and your wave offerings and your sheave offerings, if you brought all your drink offerings, if you did all that, you still weren't clean enough. You still needed a Day of Atonement offering when all of Israel was atoned for. So what does that tell you about human beings' ability to be good enough? Yeah, not going to happen, is it? I mean, think about it. God says, okay, you want to try it? You want to try being good in front of me? Want to try to establish your own justification in front of me? Here's what it would look like. Go. Even then, once a year, there has to be this big catch-all Day of Atonement sacrifice because there's just no way that this is ever going to cover the multiplicity of sins in Israel. So verse 15, then he'll slaughter the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and in front of the mercy seat, splat. And he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the impurities of the sons of Israel and because of their transgressions in regard to all their sins. And thus he shall do for the tent of meeting, which abides with them in the midst of their impurity. So he's saying the tent is impure. The furniture is impure simply by virtue of the fact that it exists in the camp of Israel and they're impure. So before I'll show up, you have to clean all that up. And you have to atone for all that. And you have to bring blood sacrifice for all that. Now, verse 17, when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place, no one shall be in the tent of meeting until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household and for all the assembly of Israel. Really important phrase. You could read past that and miss it. Was Israel the only people group on the planet at that moment?
No.
No, there's a bunch of other people on the planet. Did any of the other people groups on the planet get a book from God that said, here's how you can atone for your sin before me?
No.
No.
Did any other people group on the planet at that moment have a high priesthood that knew how to satisfy God and how to bring sacrifices to him that God would accept?
No.
Why not?
Because God didn't reveal it to him.
God didn't reveal it to him. God didn't give it to them. Mm-hmm. Does that sound like election?
Yes.
Does that sound like God picks and chooses?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, God's going to tell Israel later, I didn't choose you because you were the greatest in number. In fact, you were the least among all the people. And I didn't choose you because you were the good ones. As I think we're seeing repeatedly. I mean, for heaven's sake, Moses comes down off the mountain with the Ten Commandments. They're downstairs dancing around a golden calf they've just made. These are not the good ones. And yet God chose them and revealed himself to them. Now, when the high priest went into the holiest place to make atonement on the Day of Atonement, to atone for God's people, did he make that atonement for all the people on the planet?
No.
No. So then it's very, very specific and very, very important that the writer of Hebrews writes to the Hebrews and says that Jesus is our high priest. Does that mean that Jesus as high priest now suddenly atones for everybody?
No.
Did the office of high priest anywhere in the Bible ever atone for everybody?
No.
No. The high priesthood is specific, always was. We just read it again. When the high priest goes into the holiest place, he'll make atonement for himself and for his household and for all the assembly of Israel. Israel had their sins atoned for. Were the Egyptians any better off the next day?
No.
No. Were there any people groups on the planet that gained the benefit of what the high priest did in the holiest place that day?
No.
No. See, when we tell people, especially in this day and age in which we live. But when we tell people, you know, God is specific. God is not random. God does not just throw out there the opportunity to be saved and then sit back and wait to see if anybody will take him up on it. It's not the way God has ever acted. God has always been specific. He sent a priest to atone because he had already chosen people to atone for. He did not randomly send a priest and say, now go in there and atone, and then anybody who wants to can come take advantage of the atonement. That's never the way the Day of Atonement worked. The Day of Atonement was always, I have a people, therefore I have a priest to atone for those people. And God has never changed. Which is why it's so important to recognize and understand what the office of the high priest is and what the office of the high priest does. And the office of the high priest was never for the atonement of the world. You can't find that theology anywhere in the Old or New Testament. People want to impose it on Jesus because it seems fair. But show me in the Bible where God was ever fair. In fact, if you want fairness from God...
No, thank you.
Yeah, you're already ahead of me, aren't you? Yeah. What is fair? Fair is he's going to judge you and you're going to go to hell forever. That's fair. That's completely fair. It's totally just, that is fair. You don't want fairness. The last thing you want from God is fairness. You want mercy. You want grace. You want him to give you what you cannot and do not deserve. But you do not want fair. And people say, oh God, your God's not fair. If he was fair, he'd give everybody a chance. Oh yeah, yeah. And I say, you know, if he was fair and gave everybody a chance, then we could all go to hell collectively.
That's right.
Because nobody left to themselves is going to do the least thing that is going to draw them to God. God has to do the work. God has to do the drawing. God has to do the atoning. And by the way, if it was you, and you were going to do a hard, difficult, bloody work, talking about the work of Christ now, if you're God and you designate your son to do the very hard, painful, agonizing, the kind of agonizing that would cause Jesus to sweat like blood. I mean, this is agony I'm talking about. This is pain where he would pray to the Father and say, if it were possible, take this cup from me. I mean, this was something he understood was going to be agonizing. Now, if it was you, wouldn't you be smart enough to know that if you're going to go through that kind of trouble, you would guarantee results? Why would you go through that and then go, hope that worked? Hope something good happens there? No, God sent Christ and put him through all that because there was a guaranteed outcome. Which is why Christ will be able to say to the Father, behold, I and the children you gave me, and not a one of them is lost. How did Jesus explain the unbelief of the Jews? He said, all that the Father gives me will come to me, and him that comes to me I will in no wise cast out. You see, it's very, very specific, but it's always been very, very specific. The reason God gave Israel a high priest was because Israel was God's people, and they became God's people because God chose them. God is specific. God has intentions, and he has the power to see to it that his intentions play out exactly the way he intends for them to happen. So you know what that means? Mm-hmm. That means if you're in, man, you're in. That means if he is intending to save you, you are saved. That means no matter how much you might mess up between now and eternity, nothing can change the fact that he already did the work of atoning for you and saving you utterly and completely. There is such good news written right under the surface when you read phrases like, he sacrificed for the whole assembly of Israel. That's specific. That means that God has always known who the atonement was for. And he does not do things randomly, and he would not put his son through all of that if he didn't have you in mind. So much so that the Bible says he wrote your name down in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation of the world. Well, that's specific. If he can write your name down before he does anything, then when you get to heaven, he knew you were coming. He can open the book and go, there you go. Knew you were coming. Not that God starts sentences with, but. Verse 18, I'm very close to done. I'm going to let you go. Then he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it, and shall take some of the blood of the bull and the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altars on all sides. More blood, more cleansing, more so everything that he's going to use, everything he's going to touch, the altar, the ark, the incense, everything has to have blood on it. There's this constant work of atoning, even for the furniture. And with his finger he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it 7 times and cleanse it. And from the impurities of the sons of Israel he shall consecrate it. And when he finishes atoning for the holy place and the tent of meeting and the altar, he shall offer the live goat. Then Aaron shall lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all their transgressions in regard to all their sins, and he shall lay them on the head of the goat and send the goat away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who stands by ready, and the goat shall bear on itself all the iniquities and take it to a solitary land where he shall release the goat into the wilderness. Then Aaron shall come into the tent of meeting, take off the linen garments which he put on when he went into the holy place, and he shall leave them there, and he shall bathe his body with water in a holy place, and put on his clothes, and come forth and offer his burnt offering and the burnt offering of the people, and make atonement for himself and for the people. And then he shall offer up in smoke the fat of the sin offering on the altar. And the one who released the goat as the scapegoat shall wash his clothes and bathe his body with water. And then afterwards he shall come into the camp. But the bull of the sin offering and the goat of the sin offering whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place shall be taken outside the camp, and they shall burn their hides and their flesh and their refuse in the fire. And then the one who burns them shall wash his clothes and bathe his body with water, and then afterwards he shall come into the camp. And this will be a permanent statute for you. In the 7th month, on the 10th day of the month, you will humble your souls and do no work, whether the native or whether the alien who sojourns among you. For it is on this day that atonement shall be made for you to cleanse you, and you shall be clean from all your sins, says the Lord. And it is to be a Sabbath of solemn rest for you, that you may humble your souls. The word there, afflict or humble your souls, probably has to do with refusing your body. It was probably a fast. It probably meant that you would afflict yourself by not eating so that you could spend that day thinking about the things of God, concentrating on him because it was a high Sabbath. Verse 33, you'll make atonement for the holy sanctuary, and he shall make atonement for the tent of meeting and for the altar, and he shall also make atonement for the priests and for all the people in the assembly. And you shall have this as a permanent statute to make atonement for the sons of Israel for all their sins once every year. And just as the Lord has commanded Moses, so he did. There, we got all the way through chapter 16. Now notice it's a perpetual covenant. It's a non-stop covenant. Israel had to do it in perpetuity, continue doing it. Now they have a problem. Because ever since 70 AD, there's been no temple, no priesthood, no high priest, no holiest place. In fact, that holiest place that had that curtain where nobody could go in, when Jesus died, that curtain was torn in half from the top to the bottom. And people have speculated about why that was. I've heard people say it was torn open to let God out. I say, no, it was torn open to let us in. By the way, it was also torn open to prove that there was no Ark of the Covenant inside Herod's temple. So the whole thing didn't work anymore. So you know what the Jews did? Got to work sewing it up.
Oh.
Back to work. Back to work. Work, 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 work. Back to work, back to work. Got to cover it up. Sew it up, sew it up, sew it up. Don't let people stop our religion. Don't let the people know. Don't let them see. So all this time, though the Jews have been told that continually, in perpetuity, they have to do this every year, they really can't do it. So really, what confidence can they have in their ability to keep the rules of the law of Moses? They have found ways around it. You know, they just bring in other incense. Yeah. Yeah. You know, we'll just do it our way. We'll just make up a different way to do it other than the way God said to. But God himself, 70 AD, brought Titus the Roman general steaming into Jerusalem and burned down the temple on purpose, and there hasn't been a temple there since. There will be again, and they will start all that again. But for 2,000 years, all these generations of Israel have come and gone under the rule that they have had to keep this Day of Atonement, and they haven't been able to. And the only hope they have is to run to Christ. And it's the one thing they refuse to do. So it's good to know that the God who is absolutely sovereign filled the Old Testament with promises to his people Israel, that he has not forgotten them. And we'll get into that in some eschatological sense someday. Yes, sir.
Messianic Jews that I have spoken to say that Yom Kippur is the best day to approach a Jew with the message of the gospel.
Yeah.
That makes sense, doesn't it?
Sure it does, yeah. Because you approach them and say, where's your priest? Mm-hmm. I don't know how much more plain God has to be. He says, you can only approach me one way, and I've taken away that mode of approach. Now here's my son, and he's the only way to approach me. How guilty are people? And how depraved are people?
And talking about the Messianic Jews that he talked about, that's the argument I hear now in this town. We can't do it exactly that way, but we'll just get as close as we can.
Right. And I think we've seen the danger of doing it as close as you can. Sure.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.